Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
If our mistakes teach us so much, why do we live in the perpetual fear of making a mistake? Right? Because I don't know about you, but I learned far more about the things from the things that went wrong in my career than I did when things just went right.
Hey guys, it's Matt Haycock here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show. And today it's our segment Success in the Spotlight, where I get to pick the brains of fantastic entrepreneurs and characters and learn everything I can learn from them and hopefully share it with you guys too. And today's guest has got a hell of a career to date. Starting in journalism as a columnist for the Daily and the Sunday Mirror, she became the youngest and first female editor of Smash Hits magazine in 1995. From 1997, she started a career in, in presenting and in broadcasting. Credits include X Factor, Pop Idol, Top of the Pops, a Brits, a Royal Variety Performance. So in addition to journalism and media work, she's a qualified therapist, a successful entrepreneur, and a fellow podcaster. So welcome to the show, Kate Thornton.
Thank you very much, Matt. I'm exhausted listening to that.
I was going to say, did I do all right?
You did brilliantly.
Like, I feel like I need to take a breath.
But I just forget about all the stuff I've done. So when somebody puts it to you like that, you go, oh, I need to lie down.
well, I guess you, not only have you done so much, you've done so much in a relatively short space of time, you know, for that amount of things, and you started so young.
I think starting young helps.
Did you intend to start young? But I guess what I mean is, you know, as a youngster, were you feeling, career hungry, entrepreneurial?
Yeah. Always career hungry. Knew from a really quite early age that I wanted to be a writer, a journalist. It was the only thing I was good at school as well. I think there's this massive pressure on our kids now. We've both got children who are in secondary school, where they're made to feel like they've got to be good at everything, which is such a horrible pressure to put on a kid because nobody's good at everything. It's actually, in so many ways, about finding your thing that you are good at and then really honing that, something that gets you out of bed every morning with a spring in your step. That, you know, all the stuff you've just listed off there, I've never felt, even though I've worked hard, it's never felt like work because I've loved it. You know, I really love my job, still love my job, still learning in my role now. And I remain as hungry as probably the day that I got my first paid gig.
And I guess it's interesting that you say, you know, that as kids, you know, we can't be good at everything, and, you know, we make reference to our own kids. But I mean, that's quite a, well, I guess it's quite a modern way, when I say it's a modern way of thinking, it's still probably in the minority of people, I mean, parents who would happily say, you know, my kid excels in these, but, you know, but I'm not going to push them on these things because, you know, they need to kind of find their passion and find their focus. But how were your parents with you? I mean, did they support your dream?
Oh, God, yeah, they were amazing. And there was the only place I ever felt there was a ceiling on my ambitions was at school, which is so wrong. And I really hope that that is less and less prevalent today. And I'm pretty sure it is based on my son's experiences in education. They were amazing. Like, my dad and mum used to say, someone's got to walk on the moon. Why shouldn't it be you? Someone's got to run this country. Why couldn't it be you? And I was just raised with that. So it never occurred to me that I couldn't be something that I wanted to be I tried to be it. And then you have lots of people going, sorry.
And were they successful and entrepreneurial people themselves? Or?
No, my mum was a dinner lady at our school who then worked in Sainsbury's and then ended up working in as an office manager for a scaffolding firm locally. My dad worked nights making landing parks for aeroplanes in a factory. But I think my dad, one thing that they both taught me was try and do something you love. Don't do this. You know, I mean, they love their life and they're happily retired now. And I don't know that they have huge regrets about their working life. But my mum was of a generation where women didn't have careers, they had jobs. I am that first breed of woman that probably at my age group, I'm 47 now, that were, you know, I didn't go to university because I couldn't afford it. But, you know, women of my age were university educated and they were raised to believe that there was a possibility of being more than a nurse, not a doctor or a teacher. you know, those were women's jobs. And my generation, we were raised to think, you know, I had a prime minister who was a woman growing up. We were raised to believe that we could go out and have careers. And I remember telling my careers advice officer that I wanted to be a journalist at school. And she, the contempt and pity that poured out of her as I uttered this ambitious line, but, you know, she said, oh, have you thought about a typing pool? I mean, can you imagine things like that don't even exist anymore? I said, no, I haven't. Have you considered that I actually might be able to do this? My dad was furious. I went home and I told him, he stormed up the school. Do not allow that to happen to these kids. They've got to dream big. And I had this one teacher that I'm still in touch with to this day. He was my English teacher and my drama teacher. And he just thought I had potential. And he really encouraged me to go and discover the world and my ambition and see where it could take me. And he told me that he believed that I could be something more than a girl in a typing pool. And so I think that combination of that one teacher that saw something and brilliantly progressive parents that just were ambitious for my ambition and just went, go for it. You know, what's the worst, when I finally got into journalism school and I was turned down by every journalism course in the country, bar the one I went to. So I was feeling desperate at that point. I thought, I'm not even going to get a chance to qualify. And I believe that journalists, you know, I do believe as a journalist, you should study and you should, it's a skill, it's a profession. So it's not just something that, you know, necessarily, I mean, blogging now is something that you can do. Everyone's a publisher and you can do it as a self-starter. But back then that wasn't available to us. So I had to get an education. I had to get a qualification. It was so, so important to me. And my mum and dad both said, what's the worst that can happen? You go and you try and it doesn't work out. Just come home. We're still here. Your bedroom's still here. You know, and actually that's something I really, really feed back to my son now. It's like, I deliberately didn't use the word fail because I hate that as it's such a negative word, because if it hadn't have worked out, I still would have learned a load from that experience. And those learnings are valuable. And I think that we progress through life, certainly in an age of cancel culture, where we are so terrified of making mistakes that we forget the value of them. And that, you know, if our mistakes teach us so much, why do we live in the perpetual fear of making a mistake? Mm. Right? Because I don't know about you, but I learned far more about the things that went wrong in my career than I did when things just went right.
Well, I mean, I always say two things. You know, one, which is I only learn when things go wrong, or I think anyone only learns when things go wrong, because, you know, I guess in simple terms, when things go right, they've just gone right. I mean, you kind of almost don't know why they've gone right because you don't analyse it in the same way.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't study why did that plane fall out of the sky. You know, you would sit, if a plane fell out of the sky, you'd go, oh my God, how did that happen? But
exactly,
otherwise, we just sit there, buckle up, go, oh, chicken or beef.
Exactly.
And we don't question how the plane stays in the air. You know, the same thing applies to our endeavours in life, literally,
to everything. And you know, my main day-to-day job, if you like, is I'm a lender. And I always say, again, you know, we only learn how to lend money by losing money. Because, again, you know, you lend it, someone pays you back. Well, they've paid you back. You could say it's because they had the right accounts and they had the right bank statements and things, but you don't really know that. But it's only the ones where they go wrong and, you know, and the property wasn't worth what it was supposed to be worth, or the bank statements were fraudulent. Yeah. or the were, you know, whatever it was, and it's only, you know, it's only when you make the mistakes that you learn. I always say in lending you learn by losing, and I've lost a lot.
I've lost a lot.
So I've learned a lot, and it's very, very much the same, that, you know, the more mistakes you make, the more learnings you have. And I guess for me, it's only really a failure when you make that same mistake twice.
Correct. Yeah, or you don't extract a lesson from it.
Exactly.
And I think I would, in the same way that, you know, I would like beauty houses to stop selling me anti-aging products. You can't be anti something that is inevitable. Why can't it be pro-aging? And I think that language
youth
change.
Youth prolonging.
Just pro-aging. Because with age comes wisdom. Being old is a blessing. Especially as we're living through a pandemic, just being is a blessing. Being here is a blessing. So I don't like to be anti the inevitable. And the same with things going wrong and failing. failures are massively valuable. And it's something I really want to teach my son, is like, don't be scared of what if it goes wrong. Just be hungry for what if it goes right. And if it goes wrong, that's cool too. Like, otherwise you end up with a bunch, we will be a nation of safe.
Yeah.
Make
sure you've tried.
And actually the most interesting people are the ones that have gone out there and just given it a go. And it's only our ego and vanity that often prevents us being brave. And I mean, I'm just too old to be vain now. It's that those days are gone. But, and I've had some very public lessons that I've had to learn the hard way. And at times I thought I would, you know, would be the breaking of me. But actually, no, they've probably been a large part of the making of me.
Do you think as you became more well-known that you maybe didn't take as many risks as you would have done before? Or have you always been happy to kind of blindly ignore other people's perception?
Nothing was blind. Everything was overly probably analysed and considered, because that's the journalist in me, I suppose. Is I research everything. I think becoming well-known later in life was a blessing. And by that time, I'd already had an entire career working behind the scenes, predominantly with young people that became very, very well-known very quickly. And I saw what that did. And I also saw the smoke and mirrors, because I was the smoke and mirrors. You know, you put somebody on the cover of a magazine, they didn't look like that in the studio, but they did by the time, you know, our wizards had been to work correcting, airbrushing, propping, you know, varnishing the effect. I knew the reality versus the end product, I suppose. So I went into being a public person really with my eyes wide open and knowing the ups and the downs of it, and that it doesn't last very long. And I made a very, very conscious decision, because I really didn't want to be a TV presenter. There was an amazing woman, a female producer, that literally refused to take the word no as an answer from me about presenting a show that she was working on. And she, in the end, she convinced me to do it. It was just as I'd finished my time at Smash Hits. She convinced me to do it by presenting it as a business case. And she said, right, okay, so you've got no interest in being a presenter. I was like, absolutely none. I'm an editor. And she was like, okay, and you're going to be an editor forever, are you? I was like, well, I don't know, but you know, this is my dream job. I'm 21 years old. I'm editing my favorite magazine. Nothing's going to budge me out of this chair. She's like, you might want to think about this. This industry is in decline. It's been in decline for however many years. There's a digital revolution around the corner. At the moment, we have 5 channels in the UK. Digital TV is coming. There is going to be exponential growth in this medium, and you're going to be unqualified to work in it. Where's that going to leave you in 10 years' time? Editing what? She's like, if you want to be smart, you'll educate yourself about all aspects of television and decide where your journalistic role sits. Are you a producer? Are you a director? Are you a presenter? What if I give you a job on this show, which enables you to do a little bit of all of that? You do it for 13 weeks. Think of it as like a massive kibbutz, I suppose. And see at the end of it, if this is for you. And don't worry, no one's going to see this show. It's on a Sunday lunchtime. It was a current affairs show called Straight Up. It's on against the EastEnders Omnibus, which at the time was huge on a Sunday. So no one's going to watch it. So your ego doesn't even have to come into this. What do you say? And I'd already made the decision to leave Smash Hits, but I had signed on to be a writer with the Sunday Times, which was epic for me as a writer. Just really was so thrilled about that. And also as a contributing editor for Marie Claire, which was my favourite female glossy magazine. So I thought, actually, what have I got to lose? I can do this and do that. And there was a lesson in that as well. You don't have to be one thing, you can be two things. And we have to really be open to that in this country. We make everybody stay in their lane. And when you go to someone like the States, everyone travels multiple lanes and nobody's chastised for it. They're celebrated. So, you know, you can do more than one thing. And I decided, you know, I think it was 97 that I went into telly. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to try this. I'll just try it. And I loved it. And I never wanted to go back after that. But that didn't mean I was ready to hang up my pen. I still carried on writing. I did two things. And it used to confuse people. So what are you? Are you a presenter or a journalist? It's like, hey, how about I'm both?
Let's just rewind a bit, just I guess to getting that first job, and I guess I want to understand how you broke into journalism. Obviously, you got into the journalist school course that you wanted to do, but how did you get your first job?
And then even just getting into the journalism school required great creativity on my part, because I was not academic at school. I was good at two things, English and drama. That's it. And other than that, I just hovered around the seas. You know, I was not setting anything alight, really, apart from one teacher and my very, very loving parents. But I knew I wanted to be a writer. So I applied to do work experience on my local newspaper. So I'm from a family of workers. I had my first job at 12. I was teaching kids ballroom dancing. I worked in a hairdresser's washing hair for my auntie. I worked behind every counter conceivably known to man in cafes, bakeries, whatever. So I had a work ethic. And then I applied to do work experience on the local paper. And I did that, which was great. But then they had a vacancy part-time for somebody to go in and do the payroll for the paper boys and girls. So it was on the local free sheet. So, you know, the free newspapers you get through your doors. So I used to go in once or twice a week and I would bag up their pay. It was always in coins with maybe a fiver, if they were lucky, in a little brown envelope. And then they'd come in to get their paycheck. But that gave me a paycheck from a local newspaper. So when I applied to all of these journalism courses, I could say, I'm already working on my local newspaper. No, I wasn't. I was yeah. working in payroll. And I'd written two pieces that had my name on. And then I just cut a load of other pieces out of the newspaper that had no bylines. And I sent that off as a body of work. And that got me the interviews to get onto the course that I eventually qualified to join. That was in London at the London College of Printing. Part of the requirement of that course was you had to get two work placements for 2 weeks at a time. And it was up to you to knock down every door that you could possibly get. They weren't going to give you the work experience. You had to go out and get it. And I wrote to everyone. I mean, I remember sitting at this electric typewriter that I had, just typing furiously, anyone. And I got one work experience for 2 weeks on a women's magazine, which came to nothing. You know, I put my hand up to do as much as I could there, but it was literally like, could you just get us a coffee? And then I went to work at the Sunday Mirror magazine and I had a female editor called Kate Hadley. And she was fantastically eccentric, but really open to me. And I just said to her, look, I'm here to do and learn as much as possible. If you want me in at 8 a.m., I'm here. If you want me here till 10 p.m., I'm here. Just please put me to work. And I just kept putting my hands up the whole time, volunteering. And at the end of the 2 weeks, she called me over and said, you did great. I was like, if I don't get a job at the end of this course, I have to move home because I have no way of supporting myself in London. I'd already taken on temping jobs to support my studies. So I was working as a receptionist in a sexually transmitted disease clinic as a temp in Waterloo for a whacking £8 an hour, which was like, whoa, I was, you know, rolling in it. And I fixed vending machines for Shell Oil as a temp. And I would be in charge of broken vending machines. So I said to her, look, I'm doing all this work. I'm literally dealing with chlamydia every day in a bid to keep my fees paid.
You've got to be careful saying that.
I was, literally. Quite. And I think she just took pity on me. Or just, you know, I just laid it on, really. And it wasn't laying it on. It was the honest truth. And she said, you did good. She said, there's a job here for you when you finish your exams. I was like, oh, you're kidding. Thank you so much. Really? She said, it's £10,500 a year. Your duties will be this, but, you know, you can start when you finish your exams. And literally, I finished my exams at 1:30. And by 2:30, I changed in the toilet at college, put some hideous power suit on that I got from my mum's Freeman's catalogue, swanked up to Fleet Street, knocked on her door and said, I'm here. Where do you want me? And that was the beginning of my working life.
And it was 21 when you became Smash Hits editor.
Yeah, so I was 20 then. I stayed a year in Fleet Street and then I moved on to the job at Smash Hits.
But you effectively only started working properly, but your first proper job in journalism was at 20.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously work ethic and putting your hand up and ready to turn your hand to anything have been, I guess, key strategies of yours, and something that, you know, even talking to you off camera is still features heavily in your life. But I mean, it's still, how the hell do you go in 1 year from your first proper paid job to editor of, you know, both your favourite and the biggest music magazine at the time? I mean, there's got to be some more magic sprinkles to it than that.
Well, in that year 18 months that I was at the Mirror, they had a problem in terms of their readership. It was an old readership and it was dying as a readership, and their children, the readers that they'd had, you know, that had the paper delivered every day back in the days when people read newspapers, physical newspapers, their children weren't inheriting that buying habit of consuming that title. So they needed to win over younger readers. So I was, you know, it was like an all hands meeting, I suppose, where this was put to the newsroom. This is our problem. This is what we're facing. I was the only person on staff there under 30. And I just went to the editor and said, listen, I don't know if it'll help, but you don't have to pay me anymore. How about I write a youth column every week, which covers, you know, an interview with a pop star or a young actor, some competitions, a record review, just so that there is something in the paper for young people to read. And I think I had them at, you don't have to pay me. but that enabled me, within 6 months of getting out of college, to say that I was a columnist in a national newspaper. And the editor of that title was then promoted to the Daily Mirror, and he took me with him and took me over to the Daily Mirror. And suddenly, I 5 days a week, I had a page in a national newspaper every single day with my picture at the top of it. And that was enough to intrigue at least the publishers of smash hits to see me for that job when it became available. I knew the editor who was moving on to another title. He tipped me off that he was leaving, that there were no obvious internal candidates. So what did I have to lose by applying? Plus, I'd never been for a job interview, so I thought it would just be good experience. I knew that Fleet Street wasn't probably the right home for me. I didn't have that tabloid killer instinct. I didn't like that kind of news gathering. The idea of being the editor of Smash Hits just was joyous to me. I'd been raised on it.
Was it as fun to do it as it probably looks? I mean, I guess
that was hard work. You know, don't get me wrong. When you go in, one lesson I learned straight away was being the editor. You don't write a word apart from the cover lines. You spend more time talking to advertisers and HR than you do to your editorial team. You know, to get out of
did that disappointment may be the wrong word, but you know, was that taking you away from your kind of passion of writing?
Sure did, yeah. I mean, that's what I deliberately, when I left, I signed on with the Sunday Times and Marie Claire to be a contributing editor on the proviso that I just wrote. My job was to land big cover stories with big stars. I would set them up. I would work with the art desk and the pitch desk to create the shoots. So I had a creative input, worked with the best photographers in the world, but I wanted to get back to writing. However, no, it wasn't a disappointment in the job. That was the job. I knew what the job of an editor was. You don't just get to sit there and play with words. You know, you're running a business, you're managing a budget, you're managing a team, you're looking after staff. It taught me the things that I didn't enjoy doing, that I didn't want to do again. And I didn't want to be an editor after that. I'd edited my favorite magazine in the world. No ambition to be editor of another magazine, for example. I just certainly hadn't occurred to me to go into telly. And then this woman appeared. You know, when I was at Smash Hits, it was a huge year for pop music. So I was always having to be wheeled out to be interviewed on news at 10. And I had to do that as a way of raising awareness of our brand. That was also part of my job. So I couldn't go, oh, I don't want to do news at 10. I had to do it. It was my job. And that made me very visible, I suppose. So I kept getting offered TV shows. And it was this one woman that came along and presented this business case that I thought, maybe she's onto something. Maybe it is time for me to just keep trying new things. And I can still be a writer and a presenter. There's not many people that are doing it, but I'm going to give it a try. So I did.
And did you still enjoy writing more than presenting? Or?
I enjoy both, still do. Now I write documentaries that I present for Radio 2. I write my podcast every week. I research it every week. Everything I do, even when I was hosting The X Factor, is done through a journalistic lens. I'm a storyteller. So I could be introducing Andy on The X Factor. Well, Andy's got a story. Why should you care about him as an audience member? You know, it's down to me. And Andy's not a broadcaster. It's not for him to succinctly land who he is. So, you know, we'd have a VT on Andy, but then it was my job to, where the edit producers would decide what's Andy's story, how do we best tell it? But beyond that, I had to keep telling that story week in, week out. So even a talent show for me, I approached as a journalist.
And I mean, I was going to say, obviously having the different skills, you know, gave you more employment opportunities makes you more malleable. I was going to say, do you think that being a journalist helps you as a presenter? Being a presenter helps you as a journalist.
Totally.
But I mean, you kind of took the question out of my mouth.
For me, it does. But equally, if you're sat here watching this, you think, I want to be a presenter, but I'm not a journalist. Go for it. Just try. There's no rules, and even if there are rules, write new rules. You know. I mean, the world has changed. My working world has changed irrevocably since I started out as a 20-year-old. I edited smash hits without an email. You know, I had a mobile phone that had an aerial that you used to have to pull up and had a strap. The internet whilst it was in existence, it wasn't being used in offices. And now look at where we are. Now I present a podcast. You know, podcasts didn't exist when I came into the working world. I present digital shows that get bigger audiences than shows I would have presented on traditional telly. The world has changed. You've just got to keep adapting. And I think if you're interested in all of those technologies and all of those different ways of working, you'll stay relevant. And fundamentally, what I do is no different to what I did when I started out nearly 25 years ago. I tell stories.
Yeah.
That hasn't changed. But how they're told, where they're told, you know, the idea that you could put a show out and somebody would sit and watch it in the palm of their hand would have felt ridiculous in 1997.
Well, I mean, unbelievably, it still didn't feel much less ridiculous five years ago.
Correct,
I think,
yeah.
The speed of change.
But isn't it exciting? I mean, I get, you know, I know there's a lot of people certainly in telly that sort of scratch their heads and go, oh God, you know, this is, you know, what they see is the problems. I see the potential, I see the possibilities. And I think because I was a music journalist for so long and I specialised in music and I worked on music shows, be they X Factor or Top of the Pops, I'd seen what digital could do to an industry with the music industry. I think digital ravaged that as an industry and then forced it to reinvent itself to put it to where it is now, where streaming works, you know, and there are income revenues and there's still tweaking to be done. But the music industry has found a way to make technologies work with them, not against them. I think telly's about to go through that. And the ascent of Netflix and Amazon and Apple and the streaming platforms, combined with the fact that my son and your daughter don't watch normal telly in the way that we did when we were growing up, the world's changing. Now, you can sit there and go, oh, I don't understand change, or you can be part of the change that you want to see.
I mean, for me, the excitement and the benefit and the opportunity is in the speed of deliverability, that, you know, that everything's
changed. Speed's amazing now, though. It's almost too fast in some ways.
Well, we were talking just before we started filming about your podcast, and I think how it had gone from idea to pitch to record.
Now, the show I was talking about then was actually a show I did in lockdown called Up Close and Socially Distanced. So when did we lock down? March. So in February, my podcast I make with a company called Verizon, who are fantastic. They own Yahoo, Huffington Post, AOL, big digital content creators. But they're American owned, and they went for lockdown way sooner than anyone else. So suddenly I had, you know, guys appearing in my house, building podcast studios in my living room and setting me up for what we didn't know was coming, but we kind of knew was coming. It hadn't been announced. And suddenly all this year's work, all the shows that I had lined up started to just fall out of the diary. So I called my guys at Verizon and I just said, listen, we're about to do something like, if we lock down, this is massive. This is social history and we're living through it. It's like a massive GCSE question from 10 years time and we're living through it. We have to document it, and all the news that's flooding out at the moment is reporting on what's happening. But what we're not seeing is, like, yes, this is the worst of times, but I truly believe that the worst of times can bring out the best of people. So why don't we make a show that shines a light on the best of people in the worst of times? And that's what we did with Up Close and Socially Distanced. And I think we pitched it at the beginning of the week and we were shooting by the end of the week. And that's the beauty of digital, is that it can adapt super quick. And telly can do the same, you know, rolling news and all of that stuff. But with digital, I think that's when it really finds its moment and its pertinence. And we were able to tell these great stories either in long form, sort of three guests on every week, that were all doing something for the greater good of others. That was it. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Is it to serve somebody other than just yourself? If it is, I want to hear your story. So the woman that came up with the 8 o'clock clap, right? When we look back in the history books, we'll talk about, and people left their homes every Thursday at 8 and they clapped. Well, I wanted to know about this woman, how she'd bought that idea and how it had taken off virally. And we told those stories. We told stories about incredible men and women that were making sure people got fed. You know, doctors and nurses on the front line dealing with COVID or dealing with other departments within the NHS that were also feeling the impact. We told those stories and we did them all from My Kitchen Island, and it worked, and people, we were able to raise awareness and really valuable funds at a time when people were really needing them. So it was a pleasure to be able to use, you know, some of what I've learned along the way, coupled with a group of like-minded people and an appetite to keep telling great stories, to put that into play. And, you know, those videos live on, they're out there on the internet now, and we will look back on those times. And I'm really proud of that work, because I also didn't want to be going, adding to the woe of the nation, which was, we're in the shit. Yeah. We know we're in the shit. You only have to put the news on to know how deeply immersed in it we are. But look at the good stuff that's coming out of this as well. Not to say that offsets any of the bad. It's just, let's just balance it. I think it needed balance.
So I guess you've always been a creator and a builder, you know, in your journalistic career, presenting. And but when did that transfer over to business and creating business ideas?
Well, so now I produce jewellery and accessories, and I have a brand line, and we sell through to Next.
Was that your first business?
No. So that's what I'm doing on a business level at the moment. My first business, and the only business I ever tried to do, was I launched a digital platform that fused content with online shopping. And every time you shopped with us, we hosted about 650 brands. You got cash back on every purchase. So cashback, I think, is a really smart shopping mechanism. And it felt like it was only ever being marketed as an extremely, you know, it's smart money saving opportunity, but it was never marketed to the masses. It was deliberately targeted to those that the owners of those businesses possibly thought were serving it to people that needed to save the money. Everybody wants to save money. So I wanted to take that out to a more aspirational female-led market, wrap it in content and educate people about, do you know what, one extra click in your journey and you could save money on every purchase you make as an online shopper. So we launched TB Scene in 2016. And I learned loads. The business closed. Not through anything that we did as a management team.
Because you kill the shit. You take every question. You take every question.
And I answer it. Listen, you're an investor. We were promised a tranche of investment and it didn't arrive. As a director of that business, as the sole director of that business, if I can't pay my bills as they fall due and I carry on trading, I can't do that. That's a breach of my code of conduct as a director of a business. And asking people to carry on working, if I didn't think I could, I had the confidence in the person that was delivering that money to get it there on time, to pay their salaries. So I had to make, a heartbreaking decision. We'd spent years building this business up. It was working. And then it didn't. 5 years work, 2 years pre-launch, 3 years in the market. Everything fell apart in 5 days, it felt.
And obviously, I know we talk about, you know, learning experiences, but I mean that was obviously a big blow as you can possibly get.
Massive.
In business. I mean, did that,
and not just for me, for everybody that was in it, from the investors right down to the team that worked, you know, that came in early, left late. We were trying to do something that was really progressive, and it worked, and I'm really proud of what we did and what we achieved. I'm so sad that it ended the way that it did. But the learnings that I took from it continue to inform the work that I do to this day.
And, I mean, did it scar you at the time in terms of wanting to go back into business or doing things at that level?
Yeah. I'm not back in business. I don't run a business.
You don't consider it like that with your jewellery?
No, I'm a partner in the business, but it was an existing business. They asked me to come in. They asked me to come in and initially just be the face of the brand. And I said, no, thank you. I would only be interested in working with you if I could design, and it would be authentically pieces that I love and wear, and jewellery I'm wearing today is stuff that I've designed myself.
And do you think you wouldn't go back to running one yourself? I mean, it surprises me as someone who's, you know, he's clearly
it's so, a good, I'm, so I don't think it's what I'm good at. I don't know.
Learning from your mistakes and, you know, networked and pragmatic. And I thought you'd
still do all of that, you know, and I would still encourage anybody to start a business if you've got the energy and the appetite to do it.
Like I said, if it's not for you anyway, yeah, and if it's not where your strengths are, and you've got so many strengths elsewhere, you've got whether you've created a business or you've built opportunities for yourself, so you're just coming at it from a different angle.
But also, when I started the business, it was with two other people. One left before launch, the other left not long after launch, and I ended up holding this baby, and I was only ever meant to be there to do the content side of the business, and I very quickly had to learn out and hire in people who had expertise in all of the other areas. So I don't think, I didn't launch that business thinking I'm going to run this thing on my own. It was always as a part of a team, and that team for multiple reasons didn't end up staying together. Would I want to go back and run another business again? No. You know, the moment that finished, I launched my podcast and I thought, I'm going to do the stuff I know I can do for now. And I'm loving that. I'm a single mum. I never had childcare. So actually, I think the things that suffered most when I ran a business were my abilities to be present in any moment with my son, because I was always worried. I used to dread the end of the month because it was like, have we got enough in? Is the cash flow there for us to pay everybody? I was, you know, you're always the last person to get paid in your own business. That's a given. So actually, you know, yeah, I don't know that I have got the appetite to go back to that. I just want to be really honest with you.
Yeah, no.
And I want to be the mum that I want to be. For 3 years, I felt like I was always going, I'll be there to help you in just a second with that. One sec. Got to send what felt like a really urgent email that so could have waited. And in the grand scheme of life, was never that important. But once I committed to this business, I gave it my all, because that's what I do with everything. And I loved what I learned, and a lot of the business. So now I run a podcast and a jewelry line, and I have people that worked with me on TV scene working with me on that. So I've taken great people with me on the next stage of my journey. And I continue to collaborate, but I don't think I ever want to be solely responsible for a business in the same way.
And where did becoming a therapist come from?
I think therapy saved my life. As a child, I was an anorexic and a bulimic. And whilst I never had therapy, I used to go and sit with a GP every week and talk to her. And that was a talking therapy before we even knew what talking therapies necessarily were. And then when I became a single parent, I went back into therapy. I thought I need some help. I need some help to understand my head and my feelings. And it just felt like everything was just going round and round in my mind like a washing machine, and nothing was coming out clean and nothing made sense. I needed somebody to guide me through that. And it was transformative. And there was, you know, I didn't pop a pill. I didn't, you know, all I did was rock up every week and just put it all out there and then come out with all this food for thought. And I really worked myself out. And when my son was old enough to go to school a couple of years later, I thought, I need to learn again. And I never did university. Have I got it in me to learn a whole new skill set? And also working in our business where everything is so fast and furious and transformative in terms of technologies, maybe I do need to have a plan B. I'm financially responsible for a child. I have to be able to keep earning. And I thought therapy would be, you know, qualifying as a counsellor would tick all of those boxes for me. It would give me a career fallback. It's something I'm fascinated by, and it's something that's given me so much. So I signed up.
How long have you been qualified now?
6 years.
Do you take on clients? Have you got
big... No, I don't practice with clients because I'm qualified to. But I want to study more, and when. That the next level of study means I have to give up a lot of my work, and I'm not ready to do that yet.
But
I will do. But I think I use it a lot in my podcast and my interviewing, and you become a skilled listener.
And do you think, I mean, do you think ultimately that would become a career for you at some point?
Or is why not?
You just like it as a background skill and interest?
I loved learning. It taught me loads. I'll tell you what it did. It taught me about how to help and listen, which is massively valuable. I think as a profession, it's you know, I work in a business where there is a premium put on youth. As a counsellor, the older you are, the more wisdom you acquire. I think there's something really beautiful about that. Would I go back to it? I hope so. I really hope so. I don't see why not. You know, and what it taught me was, A, how to be open to others. It taught me loads about myself. When you study therapy, you have to go into therapy. So whilst I'd been in therapy before, when I was in crises in my life or at crossroads in my life, I'd never been to counselling or sought therapy when everything was okay. And suddenly I spent 2 years in therapy when everything was okay. And that's when you do your best work, because you dive deep. It's like trying to find a pearl every time you go down to bring up, to present in the session, so that you're not just there ticking off the hours. I thought, if I'm going to do this, let's do some really deep work. Let's look at the fundamental structure of who am I? What's my belief systems? Is my moral compass in need of adjustment? Do I like who I am? Like, who am I? I'm a mum, I'm a single parent, I'm a boss, what am I? Like, take all those titles away, who am I? And that's what I learned.
And has it made you make any fundamental changes in your health, your well-being, your rituals, your attitude?
Yeah, loads. Yeah. And it's not so much about what you do, it's how you think. I like myself now. Give myself a break. I'd stop squirming at the things that went wrong and embrace them. I talk about them, I share them, because it's nothing to be ashamed of. And it felt so shameful for so long. You know, I was fired I was let go from the X Factor, fired, whatever you want to call it. It was all over every newspaper. It was the biggest show in the country. There was a burning shame that I felt at the time of that. Nothing to be ashamed of, done nothing wrong. I'd done nothing wrong. I lost a job, you know, and I had to own that, so that the next time somebody came up to me, and for years people would come up to me and kind of put their head to one side, like in sympathy, you're okay, which all came from a great place, but it felt like I was being pitied, which pushes your sense of self-esteem lower and lower and lower, until you have to be able to say, I'm fine, how are you? And own it, control that narrative. You know, one guy decided I wasn't right for the job. Okay, no biggie. Like, there's worse things that happen in your life. It's how you enable those things to define you. And I think the one thing I learned, I am a workaholic. I love work. I've had to, whilst enabling myself to still love work with passion and always looking for, you know, oh, let's do this, let's do that.
Well, do you love it now as much as you did 25, 27 years?
Absolutely, I do. But what I've learned to do, and it's a constant progress, like work in progress, is not be defined by my work. And it probably sounds like they're both the same. Like, how can you be one without the other? How can you be a workaholic and not be defined by work? I know who I am as a person now. I like who I am as a person. I think I'm a pretty good friend. I think I'm a pretty good mum. I'd hang out with me. And then there's my work. And I work hammer and tong at it. But for a long time, I didn't tick those boxes. I didn't know who I was. Didn't particularly like who I was. I didn't know if I would hang out with me. All I focused on was the negatives. Oh, you're really annoying. You're really chatty. Oh, you're a gobshite. Oh, you're overly opinionated. Now I just go, I am a really overly opinionated gobshite, but I've got a nice heart and I'm all right, you know, and I've got enough friends that have kind of validated that, really. And my friends are really important. So I've learned that I can be a workaholic who's not defined by my work. And that's good. That's a healthier place to be. I feel like I've been through some sort of gym process with it. And now it's all in a good, healthy place. And I did that before as an anorexic. You know, I had to work out, who am I away from this illness? You know, to suffer a mental illness at that age without the understanding and education that sits around it now, is that was hard. I had a brilliant mum who got it. I had a dad that just scratched his head going, why can't you just eat? Just eat. you know, and I understood that too. There was nothing wrong in his response. So I think I had my first experience of having to learn to re-identify myself and be okay with that and hating myself, you know, and an eating disorder is a form of self-loathing. It's also a form of control. I'm a control freak. He's a workaholic. You know, all of these things are negatives if you allow them to be. I don't see the negative in being a workaholic. I don't ask anybody else to work the hours that I do. I just allow myself to do it.
But also, like you said earlier, you know, you've never felt like you've worked because you've loved everything.
There is that as well. Yeah, there is that as well. There is that as well. So, yeah. But you know what? We could sit here in a year's time, Matt, and I'd give you a different set of answers because I'll have learned something in those 12 months. And that's the one thing I know I will do. I'll try in the next 12 months, whatever this crazy, wonky world throws at us, I'll be sat here in a year's time and I will have done something new and different because I refuse to stop doing that. And if I get it wrong, I'll learn something from it.
And I guess short of any impositions from, you know, from Corona and lockdown, where is the next 12 months, 24 months likely to take you?
Who bloody knows? And that's the other thing I've learned. Stop planning, because all the stuff that's happened was never in the plan. The only plan I had was to be a journalist. The telly, the media career, designing jewellery, running a business, all of that stuff found me through whatever opportunities, conversations, network. So that's the other thing I've learned to stop planning, because life happens whilst you're busy making plans.
You just mentioned just then actually that all of these things have happened through you know, ABC and your network, and it's something that I wanted to talk about earlier but never got to touch on. I mean, obviously you are a phenomenally networked person, you know, from you know, I guess, you know, from a very, very early age. I mean, was that something you were making a conscious effort from so early?
I'm a journalist.
Is it now?
I mean, no, not at all. Never has been, never will be. So we call it network. You call it network. I call it just like, I got into this business because I'm interested in people. So, well, how can you be interested in people and not collect them as you go through life? Like, definitely filter, definitely only keep the good ones, you know, and maybe indulge a couple of the bad ones just for the sake of a good anecdote, if nothing else. But I don't think of it as network. Like, you know, you've had Tamsin Athwaite on the show. So I get a call from your PR Mark, who I work with on my show in lockdown, who was doing some great stuff. I liked him. He called up and said, would you come on Matt's show? I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And it's talking about all the stuff that we've sat here and discussed. And then he's like, well, you know, and if you could think of anybody else that you think might be in it. Yeah, definitely Tam. You know, I really, you know, she's one of my best friends, but I think she's a fascinating conversation. I hope you learn something from her.
Yep,
now, if that's great. What you call network, that's network, right? But actually, that's just me connecting with people that I like, that are doing things that I like, and I'm putting them all together. No benefit to me in that. Just a good thing to do.
But and again, that's what, yeah, what we were talking about, you know, well, both off camera and on camera, that, you know, you were always putting your hand up, you know, for opportunities, happy to work for free, happy to offer your services. And it's, yeah, it's very, you know, very much the mentality I use for things. I was telling you again before we started about my t-shirts, you know, which are,
yeah,
again, I wear, and I've, you know, done quite a few podcasts about, we say 80% of what I do for free, and then the other 20% I get fucking well paid for. And I think that's, you know, for me, that mentality or that strategy is just so important, because if on every individual thing you do, you're stopping to try and find an angle, to try and find a way to get paid, you know, to wonder, what am I getting out of this if I'm doing that for you? Then
I don't think like that.
No,
bartering completely. System of, well, if I do that for you, what are you going to do for me? I don't know, maybe there's a bit of a hippie in me that just thinks another good deed and
I think,
find,
you know,
your back.
The way I kind of operate is, obviously, you know, we all have our core business, you know, we need paying for our core business. But then effectively outside of that, you know, I look to have fun, to meet new people, to do nice things. And I guess, you know, scratch other people's backs because I will enjoy doing it. And, you know, maybe one day I'll get mine scratched back. But if I don't, I'm certainly not going to ask for it to be scratched before I scratch yours. And I think ultimately, whilst it sounds converse to getting paid for things, you know, ultimately, so it's a much more fruitful, enjoyable way of doing things.
Well, you can't just think about yourself as in life. I think that we have to think about ourselves existing in an ecosystem of other people. And you know, if, for example, that first editor who I kind of gave the hearts, you know, heart on the table story to, about if I don't get a job at the end of this, I've got to move back home, and I've been working as a receptionist in a sexually transmitted disease clinic to keep my bills paid. I will do anything, but please, God, give me a job.
Please get me away from chlamydia.
Yeah, yeah, please. Honestly, I'm up to here with syphilis. If she hadn't given me a break, right, there's nothing, there was no gain in it for her. She wasn't advertising that position. She created that position for me. She did something like that was seismic for me. It changed the course of my life. And there was nothing in it for her apart from she got another annoying kid in the office putting her hands up every 5 minutes. I'll do that. I mean, I must have got right on her nerves, but she did that for me. So from the moment she did that, I've always been so conscious of keeping my ladders down. She elevated me. My job is to keep my ladders down. So every job that I've gone into, I've tried to get to know everybody, and then, you know, try and be helpful and to bring other people along with you. You know, success is all good and well, but what's the point of standing at the top of a mountain on your own? It's bloody lonely. Success for me is being halfway up a mountain with a load of like-minded, brilliant people going, what a journey we're on.
See, this was me 3 weeks ago. I was halfway up Kilimanjaro with this guy and a couple of others, and then I got to the top.
Did you?
Yeah.
And did you go together or alone to the top?
We went together, but I mean, ultimately on that last bit, because I mean, it was 6 days up and it was supposed to be 2 days down, and we did it in a day.
Blimey. On your bum.
Pun? We just wanted out. Well, I certainly did. but no, on the last bit of the climb, which was like a 6 hour, it was supposed to be 6 hours, we were together but apart insofar. So there was only six of us in it. It's like me, Callum, another friend of mine who actually met on this podcast, and a couple of clients of his. And we, you were breaking up. You were just probably only a couple of hundred yards between us all, but that couple of hundred yards on a mountain is almost like, you know, like a couple.
But you were still together in spirit. You were together.
Oh yeah, so I was.
Yeah, metaphorically together.
The euphemism here. I was telling you practically what happened on the mountain.
No, well, I'm very impressed that you managed to do Kilimanjaro, because, you know, just the idea of the name, kill a man.
Yeah.
You know, think about it.
Well, Callum did it on 4 days' notice.
Well done, Callum. And props.
And I bought my trainers on the morning of, just before I went to the airport.
Who says you need to train it before you throw yourself up a mountain, let alone down? But yeah, you know, I think when you network is really important. And so is ambition. And those are two words that I think a lot of people have very negative connotations about. And it goes back again to changing the language around failures or anti-aging or whatever it may be. You know, everything is better when it's enjoyed together. And I've learned that, and I've never been a solo act. I've always been part of a brilliant team, no matter what I'm doing. And that continues to be the case. And I look forward to creating new teams and having new experiences. I'm hungry to learn and do more. I'm 47 and I feel like I've only just got started. And at the same time, I feel exhausted, but I won't stop. Because the world's a fascinating place to be operating in. And I really do believe that now more than ever, we can all be a part of the change that we would like to see. So for me, you know, bringing people along with you, you know, by even just by sitting in that chair as an editor at Smash Hits at 21, as the first woman, I made that an okay place to be for young people and for women, because somebody, you know, that was a door I kicked open. Well, after that, lots of women passed through that door and went on to bigger and better things. And I'm still in contact with people from those days, and we've all kind of shared our lives and experiences in different ways. And sometimes years can pass before you see them again, but you take those people with you and those experiences, and you keep having new experiences. And there's no job for life anymore. There's not, you know, we have to raise the next generation to believe that a portfolio career is a given for everybody. Mm-hmm. You don't just, unless you're a doctor or a scientist, you don't, what you put on your passport at 21 is probably not going to be the same when you're 55, for example, unless you are in one of those professions where you work in law, medicine, science, or I don't know, law enforcement. But for the likes of me, for the creatives out there, I think you've got to be open to doing a multitude of things in order to keep yourself inspired, paid. Being paid is really important as well, and knowing your value.
100%, and no one's done it better than you.
Well, I don't know. You know, listen, there's been a lot of painful lessons along the way, and some people might call them failures, and they were definitely painful, but they were definitely lessons. And it's only now, as I sit back and I look back on those and what they've taught me and the resilience that they've wrapped around me, that I understand the value in them.
Well, thanks a lot for being here today.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot for teaching me and my audience.
I've taught you nothing.
Some of the lessons. You've taught me plenty.
Have I taught you?
I always enjoy these conversations.
What do you take from these conversations? I'm intrigued, Matt.
I mean, you know, a lot of the time it's interesting to just to hear similar the same strategies that I apply or I have, but that other people maybe have under a different guise or a different slant from their careers. Yeah. I like to see the parallels between, you know, kind of completely different businesses, because I think ultimately in life or in business, there's very few fundamentals in anything, and they apply to media like they do to business, like they do to sport.
Sports are great one to analogize, yeah. Actually, yeah.
And I guess I love, you know, hearing different people's stories, different people's, you know, takes on success. And when I get to do these podcasts, I get to do it with, you know, people who failed lots, people who are still on the journey, young people, old people, men, women, you know, and people from all kind of walks of life. So it's just, I guess it's a pleasure to get to have these conversations and an honour to share them with an audience, if you like. Mm. So,
can I ask you a question?
Go for it.
What do you qualify as success now?
So I always say that success is what you make it. I would say that you need to set out what looks like success for you, and then if you achieve it, then you're successful. If you don't, you don't. And I think success as a question is always asked normally in terms of finances.
Yeah,
and people, you know, are you successful? And you know, from a monetary perspective, you could say that guy's super successful. He's just made £1 million. Well, you know, if he'd set out to be, you know, to make £1 billion, then actually he's not successful because he's not achieved what he wants to achieve. Whereas on the other side, you know, maybe someone's life goal is to be the best mother, the best wife, and the best friend that someone can ask for, and if they tick all those boxes but that's utterly skint, they are still super successful. And I think, you know, there's no right answer. It's whatever's right for you.
Totally, yeah.
But yeah, thanks a lot for being here.
Pleasure.
Thanks for keeping me on my toes.
answering all the questions before you'd ask them. Sorry, Matt.
I didn't need to be here. No, it's been fantastic.
Occupational hazard.
And guys, I hope you've enjoyed listening to Kate as much as I've enjoyed talking to her. If you like it, press like. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you subscribe if you don't already. And if you've been listening to the video version, or rather if you've been watching the video version, we're on iTunes, we're on Spotify, we're on all the other places that you can consume your podcasts. So make sure you keep coming back for lots of more guests and inspiring characters like Kate. And I'll see you again in a future episode. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for listening to The Matt Haycock Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycock. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, The Matt Haycock. And we'll see you soon.